From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, students face the possible closing of their school.
Numbers don't define our intelligence. We are way smarter than you guys make us out to be.
So how should we define a failing school? Great Lakes leaders ready to meet.
This particular summit will be very interesting because we have new leaders. So 5 out of the 8 governors are new and both premiers are new.
Recognizing women veterans.
This is a contemporary issue. It's happening today. We have 44,000 women veterans here in the state of Michigan.
And Justice Richard Bernstein on hiring physically challenged employees.
Anyone who is different will approach the workplace with a passion, with an energy, with an excitement, with an enthusiasm that is like no other.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Governor Gretchen Whitmer has declared this day, June 12th, Women Veterans Recognition Day. Today, we talk with an Air Force veteran about her time in the military and transition to civilian life.
When you're in the military, you're trained to drive on, change your socks, take a Motrin, drink some water, keep going forward. And when you bring that attitude into the civilian world, it's seen as being very aggressive.
That conversation later in the hour. But first, can Benton Harbor save its high school? The district is drowning in debt. Student test scores at Benton Harbor High are among the lowest in the state. And that's why Governor Whitmer wants to shut it down. But the community and the students are fighting back. Here's student Tanae Allen.
They don't know us. Numbers don't define our intelligence. We are way smarter than you guys make us out to be.
School officials are in a closed-door meeting today with Governor Whitmer, with her Friday deadline looming. But this is not just a Benton Harbor problem. Other school districts in our state are struggling. So how do we decide which schools are failing? Well, let's turn to Stateside's education commentator, Matinga Ragatz, and also John Young, an associate professor in educational administration at Michigan State University. Matinga, how do you define a failing school?
Well, it depends what you're looking for, Cindy. I mean, if you're looking for test scores, then tests will define whether the school is failing or not. But if you're looking for a community of people who take care of their students, who are helping the students make sense of the world, then most schools are not failing.
John, right now, how does the state decide that a school is failing? What metrics are they looking at?
Well, the state actually doesn't decide whether a school is failing or not. They try to rank the schools on various criteria, and then they use that criteria and put it into this index. And these criteria were defined by the ESSA, the Every Student Succeeds Act, and they're supposed to use indicators around student growth, student proficiency. Both of those are actually measured by test scores. They actually have to also have indicators of school quality and student success. These can include things like chronic absenteeism, advanced coursework, post-secondary enrollment. So it's a wide range of things, but that wide range of things is over a relatively narrow band of what schools actually do. In fact, there's a lot of research that suggests that schools are at their best when they are promoting a lot of soft skills. Those are skills that are related to being able to work together in groups, being able to work on complex problems over a long period of time.
In fact, Matinga, we heard at the very top of this interview Benton Harbor High School student Tanae Allen saying, numbers don't define our intelligence. We're way smarter than you guys make us out to be. How much of a student's learning is reflected in test scores?
Oh my gosh, first of all, I want to hire that girl because, you know, when we as adults make decisions, it affects these students much more than we think it does. And just to back up a little bit, I think, again, this measuring stick that we're using to measure the school performances, I think sometimes they're skewed. In my opinion, this is my opinion alone, that schools in areas of poverty are just imitations, like bad imitations of rich schools. And then we need to just look at the whole spectrum and say, okay, so what is it that these kids need to learn in order to them to cope in this community versus these other kids? I'm not saying make it unequal. What I'm saying is if the purpose of school is to teach the kids coping skills, civic skills, skills that are going to make them successful members of our society, in the age of information, it's kind of dull to kind of continue to send more information their way and then test them on the information that they know, rather than what is it that you know? Like, do you have social skills such as how to greet people or how to find a job or how to, you know, pay your bills? Do you have actual social skills that are going to make you a successful person? You know, what Tanae is trying to say is that she's got street smarts. She's got a dream. She's got the capabilities of showing that she is a productive member of her society. However, these measurements that the schools are being put through are not showing what she really knows.
And we certainly see that many of the schools performing poorly on standardized tests have a high percentage of students in poverty, more likely to be in communities of color. So what do we do with that? What does that tell us about these tests, John?
They tell us what the tests have always told us, that students that live in communities that are stressed, that have concentrations of both poverty and other types of disadvantage, tend not to do well on these tests. But that doesn't mean they can't do the critical skills that these tests are purporting to measure. For example, the current test that we use, the M-STEP, has a lot of skills that are necessary to perform well on it that are really not related to whether or not you know the content or not. And an example of that is, as you're going through the test itself, it's a computer-based test, and students have to actually scroll through the reading section on the right while they're answering questions on the left. And that could be actually a very difficult task to do if it's not something you do every day. And you can see how students that come from wealthier families that might have access to computers and the internet in the home might have an advantage doing those things. This is actually a really high cognitive load on the students. So asking them to type, to scroll, to do a whole bunch of multitasking things while at the same time answering relatively difficult mathematics and English language arts questions isn't necessarily getting at whether they understand the content. It's whether or not they can take this particular test at that particular time.
John, you make a good point when you brought up the idea that these kids are coming from a stressed environment. Poverty is a stressful thing for young children, and for them to be asked, again, to not only do these highly cognitive tasks, but then to concentrate today in a day that they may or may not have eaten, they may have had some issues at home, it's really deficient. And so to continue as a society, I think, to press this measurement stick as the only measurement sticks to understand whether a school is failing or not is really detrimental to the kids. And I think it just deviates from the purpose of school.
So what else could or should the state be doing, be measuring when deciding if a school is doing a good job educating its students?
So, Sydney, I just want to kind of disentangle these two cases,
okay.
Right?
Yes.
When we're trying to figure out how to improve schools, sometimes tests can be useful to that. So looking as a very gross measure, you can get a sense of how a school is performing, because we want all schools to perform well on these tasks. So I'm not saying that we should do away with tests. I'm saying that these tests should not be the number one indicator of whether a school is successful or not. Having said that, the use of these particular tests in closing schools is different from what do we do to improve these schools.
Right.
And I think it's important to make that distinction. I mean, currently, our accountability system does not actually have a clear yardstick for deciding which schools get tapped for closure, which is a completely different decision than trying to understand which schools need to improve. The way the current system is set up is it's set up to look at the bottom 5% of schools or schools that are not having graduation rates of 67% or higher, and trying to improve those schools over time. I don't necessarily think that's a terrible idea to say which schools need our help.
Exactly.
And if they're really then getting assistance to improve and meet their goals, have these goals a little bit more tied to the community goals and the community desires, I think is the critical part of this. If we want schools to improve, we have to enlist the local community and the local teachers to make that happen. And the way the current system is set up, we're essentially using the assessment system as a stick, which basically says to the teachers, you're not doing your job. And the real problem with an assessment system, an evaluation system that does that, is the very teachers and the very people that you're saying are the problem have to be a critical part of the solution.
So, John, in my opinion, I feel that the schools that are having issues, like the Benton Harbor High School, I think they should be given a pass. I believe that sometimes teachers cannot perform because they are in a box, and you're trying to deal with the student social issues and the school closing, and you're still trying to get these kids to pass these tests, because these kids got tested this year the same way as the kids that were in the schools that did not have these problems. So I'm thinking, not giving them a pass as in just do whatever you want, where, you know, forever, but just say for the next 5 years, you know, let's just take the Harry Potter wand. For the next 5 years, you guys sort this out and then report to us how you're sorting this out and create your own case study rather than asking these schools to continue to perform like the schools that don't have these issues.
I think it's also important to note that Benton Harbor probably would not be on a closure list if they were not financially stressed. Michigan has not really made a habit of closing schools over time. They generally only close schools when there are severe financial issues. And part of them not performing well, I think, is just a byproduct of falling enrollment over time, which ends up being really problematic. I mean, 20 years ago, Benton Harbor High School had nearly 1,200 students enrolled, and currently they have about 640.
Taking that in our final few moments here, does closing a school like Benton Harbor High, the way Governor Whitmer's proposing, does that make a better situation for students?
Cindy, it's kind of like saying, does divorce make it a better situation for the kids? It's complicated. You know, for a high school kid, having their high school building close is very much like the Twin Towers coming down. It's traumatic. And then these kids are going to go into schools where it's not their community. They are going to have to speak in a different language, really, whether they're speaking English or their version. They're not going to know how to navigate the system like their peers are going to know how to navigate the system. So they are refugees. They're almost like migrating to a different country. So it's going to be really difficult. And these kids are going to be continued to be tested in the same exact way without having these things into consideration. It's not a solution, but it is also the realities of a systemic problem that we've had for decades.
I also think in some ways it's a way to pass the buck, because to a certain degree, these kids in Benton Harbor have not been well served by the structure that surrounds them. When they go into these other schools, they're going to be absorbed by other structures and their story might be lost. And I think that's really problematic. If they are going to close these schools, there has to be a really comprehensive plan, and there has to be a real plan in the receiving schools for how they're going to be received. And I think without that, you're doing a real disservice to the kids at Benton Harbor.
Sure. John Young is with Michigan State University's College of Education, and of course, Matinga Ragatz is Michigan Radio's education commentator. Lots of stuff to dive into, and we want to thank both of you for doing that.
Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you.
Coming up, Justice Richard Bernstein talks about overcoming his physical disability and why employers should give people who are, quote unquote, different a chance. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Great Lakes and St. Lawrence governors and premiers will hold their 2019 Leadership Summit this Friday and Saturday. It'll be in Milwaukee, and it will be the first summit for 7 of these 10 leaders. And you can bet industry and environmental leaders will be watching very closely. One of them is Mike Schreiberg, Executive Director of the National Wildlife Federation's Great Lakes Regional Office. Good to see you again. Mike, what exactly happens during this summit?
Yeah, so what happens is the governors and premiers get up and they talk about their agenda. They do some press events, they do speeches at this, and then there are sessions that dig deeper on particular issues, whether they're water issues, maritime trade, energy and commerce are some of the key ones that they're talking about.
Every year since he has been president, Donald Trump's budget proposal guts the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. Just to track things, the first Trump budget zeroed out the program. The next 2 years called for slashing the $300 million program to just $30 million. And every year, members of Congress from the Great Lakes states fight to preserve the initiative and that funding. Are we seeing any new ideas and any measures from Great Lakes governors to protect the Great Lakes from these kind of attacks on the federal funding?
Yeah, well, I think the governors are playing a more and more critical role, because I think our federal government has largely abandoned much of the Great Lakes progress. Now, I will say Trump actually wound up reversing course and actually supporting the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. But that came after pressure from our Congress people here in Michigan and across the region, as well as the governor.
And Michigan is political. politically important to his reelection hopes.
That is true, as is Wisconsin, mm-hmm. as is Ohio, as is Minnesota. So we sit in a region that has rich electoral possibilities, and part of what you see is that helps drive federal policy.
So do we see a place where governors can come up with alternative ideas? I believe Mike DeWine in Ohio came up with the idea of let's have our own pot of money. So we've got a cushion against what may or may not happen in Washington.
Yeah, and you're seeing that across the region in different ways. So Governor DeWine is doing a great job of advancing a Ohio water funding piece, mm-hmm. which actually would help clean up Lake Erie. Now, this has to be a complement, not a substitute for federal action. That's where sort of the rubber hits the road. The Farm Bill and the Clean Water Act are really the drivers of water quality in Lake Erie, which obviously has this massive algal bloom problem, which is predicted this year to be one of the worst on record. Mm-hmm. But Governor DeWine is looking creatively at state solutions that should be a complement, not a substitute for federal.
To the point of these blooms on Lake Erie, the cyanobacteria, how do you want to see Governor Whitmer working with Governor DeWine and also Ontario Premier Doug Ford to combat this threat when, as you say, we're hearing it could be one of the worst ever this summer?
You know, Governor DeWine and Governor Whitmer will be together this weekend. It's important that they reaffirm the commitments to Lake Erie that their predecessors had. And that was, to be specific, reducing pollution by 40%. That would take off the worst of the harmful algal blooms that we're seeing. And so we'd like to see the governors get together, work collaboratively on that, and set specific measures, specific targets for watersheds so that we get down into the details beyond platitudes and into action on Lake Erie.
Asian carp. The governor of Illinois just signed on to the Army Corps of Engineers plan to protect the Great Lakes from Asian carp. As we recall, the state's last governor would not do that. So now what?
Well, so we're getting towards agreement with the governors and premiers in the region, and that is a huge step, not one to be underestimated. There's still a lot of details to be worked out about funding and things, but if the region speaks with one voice to Congress, I am confident that we will get the funding in place for the Brandon Road Lock and Dam. That is the choke point south of Chicago where you could stop the advance of Asian carp if we get protections in place quickly enough.
What are you looking for from the governors in response to PFAS? I mean, we certainly hear that Michigan has the most PFAS sites in the nation. Well, we're actively looking.
Yeah, and I think you actually in part made the point with that question. We need every state to do the level of testing that Michigan is doing. Michigan is leading the way in testing, has committed to setting stronger standards. We should see those around the region. I would love to see the other governors follow suit with what Governor Whitmer is moving forward with. And that means looking for PFAS, doing the testing, and then setting common standards that are protective of public health. Doesn't exist now. This is one area, getting back to your original question, I would not look for help from the US EPA on this. It's going to be the states leading for the foreseeable future. And I think that's going to be an area, and we've heard rumors that there will be some sort of resolution on PFAS coming out of the governors this weekend. We'll see if that happens or not on Friday or Saturday.
Okay. And more generally, you know, it's interesting. We realize we're looking at political leaders from the Great Lakes states and also from the provinces. Are there international differences that we see in how we manage and protect the Great Lakes versus the Canadians? Do they have different priorities or different approaches?
They do have some different priorities and approaches. They often have a stronger regulatory framework for most issues, but they have less funding going to it. They don't have the equivalent of the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. And, you know, this particular summit will be very interesting because we have new leaders. So 5 out of the 8 governors are new and both premiers are new. This last gathering under 2 years ago, only 3 of the people will be the same. That's amazing for the 10 governors and premiers in the region. So this is a transition time, an important moment to see what the region is on the same page about and what are some of the big differences.
So what will you be watching for or hoping for?
Yeah, I mean, it's a few things. One is the tone. So where are there going to be joint resolutions? Where are there going to be proclamations, particularly in the water space? Mm-hmm. But looking specifically, if we're going to be talking about water infrastructure, structure and affordability. We have a $179 billion backlog just in the U.S. portion of the Great Lakes on water infrastructure. This is one of the reasons why we had the Flint water crisis. Multiple causes, but this is one of them. It is primary cause of why we're seeing water shutoffs devastating Detroit. Are the governors going to get together and powerfully advocate for federal funding for water infrastructure, which has been declining over decades? That's the type of joint priority setting and powerful force I'd like to see. Because as we mentioned before, this region is politically powerful. Mm. We have a new set of leaders. How much will they align and what will they be asking for are the key questions going into this weekend.
People do criticize the conference for being a lot of pomp circumstance, maybe window dressing, because you're talking about resolutions and proclamations. Doesn't have the power of law. What are your thoughts?
Well, that's true. I mean, it is a lot of pomp and circumstance. There's no way to get around that. You've got sitting governors speaking, you've got senators and other things. To me, the important things are what comes out of this, because each of these folks have a ton of power in their own states, of course, and they can help set the agenda regionally and then implement it home. So this is, by definition, this is a ceremonial event. There is nothing that happens as the force of law. But commitments to go home and take action in your own states are what we hope to see out of that. And that is the high value of this gathering.
Mike Schreiberg, Executive Director of the National Wildlife Federation's Great Lakes Regional Office. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
People with disabilities, people who are quote unquote different, bring an invaluable perspective to the workplace. They just need to be given a chance. That's the message our next guest plans to convey to hundreds of business and community leaders on Thursday. And Richard Bernstein would know. Elected in 2014, he is Michigan's first state Supreme Court justice who is blind. Justice Bernstein said if his open seat had been filled by appointment instead of statewide election, things would have been very different.
If I had to go in front of a merit selection committee, there is no chance that I would be serving on the court today. Because what would happen is they would see someone like me and they would say, oh, wow, that's so inspiring that this blind person wants to be a judge. But when the doors close, they would say, you know what? This might be too difficult. It might be too hard. It might be too challenging. Let's go with someone who looks like us or sounds like us or is us.
I recently sat down with Justice Bernstein ahead of his keynote speech to benefit JVS Human Services. It's a nonprofit providing assistance, including job placements, for more than 10,000 Metro Detroit residents. I started our conversation by asking just how much his arrival shook up the daily norms of a state institution like the Michigan Supreme Court.
But what was great was, is that, look, the court has functioned pretty much the same way for over 200 years. Now, all of a sudden, you have a blind person coming onto the court. And it did require a lot of change and transformation for the court to have to go through. One quick example would be, every Wednesday, we have conference. At conference, there are 26 cases, for the most part, that you're going to decide whether or not you're going to grant leave to. Now, people say, well, how do you do that if you're blind? Mm-hmm. You know, do you put it into Braille? Well, you can't put it into Braille because Braille is ineffective. If I give you one textbook page, you're going to give me 65 Braille pages. So that's just not going to work.
No.
You can't use a computer because if you're listening to your headset, you can't hear the conversation, which renders you irrelevant. So that doesn't work. So how do I do it?
Yeah, how do you do it?
Every Wednesday, I memorize all the cases that are on the docket. I learn the cases backwards and forwards. Now, there's no way I'm going to memorize like a month-long murder trial. That's not possible. But I will know all the key legal issues that are part of that case. Now, keep in mind, we're a common law system. So not only do you have to know the case that you're voting on, but you have to know all the other relevant corresponding cases. Because if you feel that someone deserves a new trial, you can't just say, oh, that's unfair. Mm. You have to cite cases and you have to be able to discuss those cases. Then you have to know all the cases that work against you so that you can discuss why those cases should be distinguished from the case at hand. But what I tell my clerks is, look, people's lives are at stake. We asked for this position. Yes, we have to work 12 hours a day. Yes, we have to internalize. Yes, we have to memorize. Yes, we're not going to sleep very much. But at the end of the day, we asked for this opportunity. The people gave us this opportunity. We have no choice but to do this well.
Give me a sense of what it takes for you to memorize those 26 cases every week. Does someone read them to you? What happens?
So what the court will do as a modification is that I get one additional clerk, which makes all the difference in the world. So the other justices have four clerks. I have five clerks. And that's absolutely essential. And the reason is because it just takes us so much more time to process and understand the information. The typical ratio that you would use is that if it takes you 1 hour to prepare for something, it will take me 5 hours to do the same thing. So you just have to have more manpower to be able to do that. And this is one of those situations where, as great as technology is, it isn't going to work in this situation, because you need a clerk who knows you, knows what you're looking for, who's going to pinpoint a lot of the key issues of the case and be able to bring that to your attention. And you also have to have clerks that are passionate, that are enthusiastic, and realize that working for a blind justice is going to be more challenging than working for someone who is sighted. Mm-hmm. But I think the benefit of that is, on a multi-court situation, is that you bring a different perspective. You bring a different understanding to cases. And I think that's really what it's all about, is being able to look at things in a different way. If you had seven people who are all the same, things get missed. If you have people that are different, then I think you're able to serve people better.
You're headlining the 22nd annual JVS Human Services Strictly Business event that's happening this Thursday. What's your message going to be?
My message is that giving people with disabilities, giving older people, giving people who've been out of the workforce, giving people that have faced challenge and hardship in their lives an opportunity to work, an opportunity to be trained, can make all the difference in the world. And this is the key thing. Anyone who is different will approach the workplace with a passion, with an energy that is like no other. And the key is for employers to realize that people who are different know what they're capable of, but it's people who are more traditional that have to give us the opportunity and have to give us the chance.
It strikes me that you're very aware of the precedent you're setting for other institutions, other workplaces, schools, to try to demonstrate through what you are doing on the court and what the court, how the court accommodated itself to your needs.
Exactly.
You can do it.
Exactly. But there's a little bit more to that. And I do think it's important to mention. According to the U.S. Census, 85% of blind people are currently unemployed. That is not because people who are blind are not passionate, are not hardworking. It is solely socioeconomic. I have been blessed. I come from an amazing family with incredible support. I also come from an ability to have tremendous financial resources. I had the best of everything. Mm-hmm. If I hadn't come from the background that I come from, there is no question that I would be part of the 85% who are currently unemployed. There is no question.
How can Michigan and we Michiganders do better for the Michiganders living with a disability?
Well,
what's missing?
I think what is really critical is job placement is probably one of the most important things. I mean, look, we can have a discussion about transit, education. Mm-hmm. There's a large number of looming issues that we could have, you know, a focus on. But what it really comes down to is job placement. Because once you have a job, everything else kind of falls into place. The thing is, and I'm just going to be totally direct and candid. When I went to Northwestern, I graduated from Northwestern Law School in 1999. In 98 is when you go to interview for your, you know, law firm positions or law firm opportunities. Now, I always knew I was going to do public service. I always knew I was going to come back to work in my family firm. I always knew I was going to do pro bono. But I wanted to see if I could get a job on my own. I wanted to see what would happen when I went through the interview process as a blind person. Northwestern had a 100% job placement rate in 1999 and in 1998. The economy was booming. Law firms couldn't find enough lawyers.
They Great were begging, school. Yeah.
They were begging for lawyers to come to work for them. I went on 65 job interviews when I was at Northwestern. The rule was, if a law firm came on campus, anyone that wanted to interview with that law firm would be given the opportunity to interview that law firm. So I went on 65 interviews with 65 different firms. Of the firms that I interviewed with, not jobs, how many callbacks do you think I would have gotten?
I would have expected a lot.
How about zero? Not a single one. And the reason was because what would happen is, and when you talk about it with mm-hmm. career services, is that what employers would do is they would say, you know what, this is a really inspirational story, and this is great, and this is really exciting. But, you know, we've got a lot of people, and why don't we just move on to the next person? Mm-hmm. Because why do we have to go through and make all this effort and do all this work if we can just go on to the next person? What we're trying to do at JVS Human Services is the idea that don't go on to the next person, because there's an actual benefit to hiring somebody that you otherwise wouldn't hire. There's a benefit to hiring somebody that you think is a disadvantage. They have an advantage. It's not a charity. This isn't about like, wow, I want to give this disabled person a job, or I want to give this senior a job, or I want to give this unusual person a job. You're not doing a charity. What you're doing is you're doing something where you're creating a better environment because you're creating a different perspective, and you're getting some of the finest people that you could ever possibly get. I'll just tell you this, right? When I would do these interviews, when I would do these things, I guarantee people have a certain perspective when they look at me, kind of how I appear to them, you know, the blind guy, right? Walking into the wall, doing the usual stuff. Most people are shocked when they hear this, because they just assume that, you know, if you're blind or if you're different, you know, you don't do athletic competitions. That's not something disabled people do, right? Do you know I've done 22 marathons? 22 marathons. Do you know I've done a full Ironman competition? So what you come to find is when you work with folks who are a little out of the mainstream, or who look weak, or who look vulnerable, what you will find is that those are the people who have the strongest and most powerful spirits.
Justice Richard Bernstein, Michigan Supreme Court, you're showing everyone how it's done. And it has been a pleasure to talk with you, and please come back.
Thank you. I hope you'll have me back, because we have so much more to talk about. I get really excited. So thank you for this opportunity.
Still to come, recognizing women veterans and the challenges they face.
I had the honor of dropping the puck at the Winter Classic, which was amazing. It was myself and a gentleman who had both served, and they listed him as a veteran and me as his wife.
That comes up in just 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's Wednesday, and you know that means it's time to talk our state's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center.
I, Gerald R. Ford, do grant.
The other passengers there reluctantly gave up their seats, but I refused.
The young man makes up his mind to work. There's no limit to what he can do.
This is truly the next chapter in General Motors' recovery and turnaround.
You're living at a time of extremism, a time of revolution.
With the 75th anniversary of D-Day, we're thinking a lot about the military heroes of World War II. Well, we're about to talk about a highly decorated war hero who got through the war and then lived out his retirement at the Detroit Zoo. Rachel Clark of the Michigan History Center is here to tell us about G.I. Joe, a fine-feathered war hero. Rachel, just who was G.I. Joe?
G.I. Joe was a carrier pigeon who was born in 1943 in Algiers, North Africa, and he was used by the U.S. Army in World War II.
So the Army Signal Corps, right, was using carrier pigeons. How so? How were they using these carrier pigeons?
So carrier pigeons, or homing pigeons, they've been used in military for centuries. And essentially what they would do is send pigeons out with a unit that was going out on either a patrol or a mission. And if a message needed to get sent back to the front lines, they would tie messages in these tiny little tubes to the leg of the carrier pigeon. And the pigeon would go back to its home roost. And they would have bells on these roosts. And when the bell rang, a member of the Signal Corps would know that a message was received via pigeon.
It's so efficient. And you know, of course, anybody who's been watching Game of Thrones, we know where they got the idea of the ravens coming out with
the exact same thing.
Absolutely. As you see Lord Varys tie a little message to the leg of one of the ravens. I love it. So I know that reports from that time, I'm looking at, you know, Lewis Cook's report in the Detroit Free Press talking about him, that G.I. Joe was hailed as the most outstanding military pigeon in history, and the Lord Mayor of London even personally decorated him. So what did G.I. Joe do that was so important?
So G.I. Joe, he flew 20 miles in 20 minutes to deliver a message to American forces canceling a bombing mission that would have killed 1,000 British soldiers. So these British soldiers were to attack an Italian city, but before they arrived, the U.S. support command, air support command, where they were going to bomb the city and sort of clear the way for these British troops.
You'd often see that where they would soften that up.
Yeah.
They would soften up the target before the infantry came in.
Yes. So the British soldiers arrive and the Germans retreated. They didn't even really fight back. So the British unit got into the city early and needed to cancel that bombing mission. But the communication lines were down. None of them were working. Mm. So they sent G.I. Joe back to cancel this bombing mission because otherwise you have 1,000 British men that were potentially going to get killed in this bombing raid.
So he did it.
He did it.
And so he got this award after from the Lord Mayor of London. And and how did G.I. Joe wind up spending his retirement years at the Detroit Zoo?
So after the war in 1946, after he was awarded the Dickin Medal for Gallantry by the Mayor of London, he was sent back to New Jersey. The U.S. Army Pigeon Training Center was in New Jersey. So he spent some time there. And then when the program was actually discontinued in 57, the birds were being sent to various zoos. And a gentleman named H. Lynn Pearson, he was the president of the Detroit Zoological Society at the time, he petitioned aggressively for G.I. Joe. Everybody wanted G.I. Joe, and he got him. So G.I. Joe ended up coming to Detroit.
I understand G.I. Joe got a fellow vet to hang out with and swap war stories
with. He got a buddy named C.O.D., who he was a little bit younger, and he flew 20 missions in the Mediterranean through storms and anti-aircraft fire. So he was also a decorated war hero.
Did the Detroit Zoo do any special exhibit so when people came in, they knew they were looking at war hero pigeons?
They did. They were right at the gate and they had plaques explaining who they were. So everybody understood why there are these two. Actually, there were four carrier pigeons because the G.I. Joe and COD were able to bring their mates with them. And so it explained why there are these carrier pigeons right at the entrance of the zoo.
That is just great. How long did these birds live?
They lived for a little bit. G.I. Joe died in June of 1961, and I believe that COD died shortly thereafter.
My goodness, when I think about it, I was taken to the zoo as a kid. I bet we walked right past. I probably did. I don't remember seeing G.I. Joe, but going to the zoo was a huge thing because you'd get to ride on the little train and you would go right past. And that was at the entrance. So I probably walked right by G.I. Joe and COD's coop and didn't realize that I was looking at a war hero. How did you hear about this story?
It was just listed as a random factoid in something I was looking at. So I started looking into it, and I have to say thank you to Tom Schneider, who is the curator of birds at the Detroit Zoo. I reached out to them, and he immediately responded and gave me the information that they had. So it just seemed very very sweet story, very different than other war stories that we hear, and I just was very interested in it.
The war hero, G.I. Joe, the carrier pigeon who flew 20 miles in 20 minutes, warning off Allied bombers and saving the lives of 1,000 British troops in an Italian village in October 1943, and then retired to the Detroit Zoo. Rachel Clark, Michigan History Center, a great story. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Governor Gretchen Whitmer has declared today Women Veterans Recognition Day. In a press release announcing this declaration, the governor was quoted as saying, "Michigan women have been stepping up to serve our country for generations, and it's time they get the respect and recognition they earned." Well, there are nearly 44,000 women vets living in Michigan, and one of them is here with me now. Stephanie Zarb served in the U.S. Air Force from 2006 until 2011, and that includes being deployed to the Middle East. From 2013 to 2017, she directed a statewide nonprofit that served vets. Welcome back to Stateside, Stephanie. It's good to see you.
Thank you so much for having me back.
When you got out of the Air Force and you came home to Michigan, what was it like being a new female veteran?
It was actually very shocking. So I come from a long line of really strong women. I have a long tradition of service in my family. It never occurred to me that I was a female member of the service. You know, it wasn't something that really played a big role in my day-to-day life on active duty. So I was really surprised when I came home and learned that the veteran community and maybe society at large was still not aware, maybe, that women serve in the military, how women serve in the military. They really didn't associate me with being a veteran. And I was really shocked to see that still sort of prevalent in society. Pretty saddened by it as well. It was a big culture shock coming back.
Did you see yourself as a veteran?
No, I didn't. I, like many veterans, when I came home, thought veterans were people who had served in very specific combat roles. And that's actually not true. That's not the definition of a veteran at the federal level, at the state level, nor should it be a definition anyone holds themselves to. But unfortunately, and I think this is common amongst male veterans as well as female veterans, we all feel like we should have done more, we could have done more. And I think are a little leery of taking that title of veteran.
When did you finally realize that you were a veteran and your service mattered as much as any man's?
Well, actually, it took a very long time. So I came home in 2011, and I struggled. I struggled, like many veterans, to find a job, to find my place in society. And that, I think, is just a function. When you're in the military, you're trained to drive on, change your socks, take a Motrin, drink some water, keep going forward. And when you bring that attitude into the civilian world, it's seen as being very aggressive, potentially even more so for female veterans. So it takes a little bit of a time in the civilian world to realize that you need to approach things a little bit differently. You need to act a little bit differently in the workplace. And I guess I'm a little bit of a stubborn learner. It took some time. But really, it was in 2013 when I realized that I was eligible for things like getting health care at the VA, that I could get, you know, a free Bloomin' Onion at Outback Steakhouse, those sorts of things. But then even when I qualified for VA care and I understood as a post 9/11 veteran who had, you know, deployed and come home that I qualified for these things, I still didn't really feel worthy of going and doing those things. And that feeling was really reinforced in society. And it wasn't malicious in most cases. It was not malicious. It was little things like walking to a VFW hall and being asked if your father's a veteran, which in my case he is. So, you know, we could have a conversation about that. Going to the VA, and because I spent a lot of time in the VA doing other things, and, you know, being asked, oh, did your husband serve or did your father serve? Occasionally I'd be asked to speak, and almost inevitably when I'm asked to speak, somebody will ask if I'm there to sing the anthem, which is a little bit of a double thing for me because I happen to be tone deaf on top of it.
Something they weren't asking the guys.
Right. Certainly they wouldn't ask a man if he was there to sing the anthem. I had the honor of dropping the puck at the Winter Classic, which was amazing. And the subsequent story that I posted in the newspaper, it was myself and a gentleman who had both served, and they listed him as a veteran and me as his wife. We had met that day, so. But, you know, so it was these little things that kept happening that were really making me feel really, you know, when you hear it day in and day out, you start to internalize it. It can really make you question, you know, why is this happening? And again, I'm not saying it's malicious. I'm not saying it's intentional. It's just something that's out there.
It, as a veteran, as a woman, what are your thoughts about Governor Whitmer's declaration that today is Women Veterans Recognition Day?
Well, first of all, I think it's a fantastic step forward. I know that there's some mixed feelings out there. Is this saying women aren't included maybe in Veterans Day? And I think that this is really important. I think when people think about women veterans issues, they think that these were things that were settled in the 40s and 50s. You know, they're talking about, you know, women were allowed to serve officially in the military 1949, I think, President Truman. But what they don't realize is that it was actually 1994 when women were barred from combat, which is not ancient history. It wasn't until 2016 that women who had served prior to that 1949 law were allowed to be buried in national cemeteries. It wasn't until 2013 that women were allowed to serve in combat. And then 2016, I believe, women were given the ability to choose any what's called an MOS or AFSC, which is any job that all the jobs were opened up to women. In fact, when I was in the service, I did okay in the service. So I ended up being Company Grade Officer of the Year, which is a pretty big honor. And I'm not saying that to brag. I'm saying that to say, like, I was okay. I was number one of the company grade officers in my wing. And part of that was being able to choose your follow-on assignment. And I wanted to be an ALO. And I went to talk to my commander about it.
What is that?
It's an air liaison officer. Okay. And he told me it wasn't open to women. And I remember being really shocked, you know? Wow, okay, I can't do this job. It was a little bit of a double slap in the face when the job went to a male officer whose career was really in trouble. And it was given to him to try and revitalize his career. That wasn't a great moment. So for me, you know, these dates are really important. And seeing this progression is really important. But it's also really important to say that women veteran issues, this is a contemporary issue. It's happening today. We have 44,000 women veterans here in the state of Michigan. Every single one of their service is something to be celebrated, something to be recognized. And I think it's great that Governor Whitmer is recognizing today as that.
If you've just joined us, we're speaking with Air Force veteran Stephanie Zarb on this day that Governor Whitmer has declared as Women Veterans Recognition Day. You're a graduate student now, but I know you spent 4 years directing a statewide nonprofit that helped veterans. So you know the state landscape pretty well. Where does Michigan need to improve when it comes to servicing our veterans, women and men?
That's maybe the downside of this day, or maybe a little bit of the disappointment. really excited to see women veterans recognized in this way, but I was also very excited to see Governor Whitmer get elected. I had really high hopes that she was going to focus on veteran issues. I was part of the Veterans for Whitmer group and was thinking that she was going to pay attention to some of these issues that are really serious here in Michigan. One reality, whether you're a male or female veteran here in Michigan, is that you lag behind your peers in terms of connection to your benefits. A lot of people want to say really negative things about the VA and how hard it is for veterans to access care. What they don't understand is that it's not actually the VA that does that access piece. It's actually something that state governments do. So here in the state of Michigan, we have the Michigan Veteran Affairs Agency, the agency specifically designed to ensure that veterans have access to service officers, VA-accredited service officers, that help them access their benefits. And I think, as we all know, Michigan lags far behind other states. Maybe it's not something we all know. Not only do we lag behind other states, but actually MVIA was set up in 2013, and we've actually lost ground since 2013 in terms of the percentage of veterans who are service-connected. So I think that that's a real issue. I think the reason that we have an issue, we just don't have enough service officers. And to be quite honest with you, it's not a very high paying position. So there's not a ton of people that are looking to go into that line of work. And what it's resulted in is a situation where it could be that you live in a county that doesn't have a county office, that doesn't have a VA accredited service officer from the service organizations. It could be that you have to drive a few hours to get an appointment to meet with someone that can explain your benefits to you, review your military records. So that's hard, no matter who you are. And then if you're a female veteran and you go to see a service officer and you have a poor experience, which can happen at times, I'm not saying it happens all the time, it's probably a little more prevalent for women, then you have to start all over again. And I know when I went to get service connected, I actually had to go all the way up to Alpena is where I went to get service connected. I had to go that far to find a service officer that would work with me, that would take me seriously. And I'm not trying to dissuade anyone from doing this. It's so important. But I also think it's important that beyond recognizing female veterans, we recognize that there's, you know, barriers to all veterans here in Michigan accessing their benefits. And that's the most important thing I think we can do for our veterans.
And I know the MVAA recently launched She Is a Veteran, and a press release describes it as a 3-year campaign to recognize women vets for their service, help them tell their unique stories, and connect them ultimately to the benefits and services they've earned. Are you encouraged?
So I think it's great. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And I think it does make, you know, female veterans seem more relatable. It helps other veterans maybe not assume that women aren't veterans. So that's important. But I don't think that feel-good stories are very helpful in a state where we have these really concerning, deep, systemic issues and barriers to veterans getting connected to their benefits. Only 18% of Michigan veterans are connected to their benefits at all. That number is significantly lower if we look by percentage at women veterans, minority veterans. That's where there's ground to be made up. There's a lot of clear ideas from other states on how to do that. And I think that's really where, as a Michigan taxpayer, I'd love to see attention focused, because that's how you change lives.
What will you be watching for?
What I would love to see is to see Michigan become a player in this space, to see Michigan rise to the top of that list, you know, instead of 49th, to be number one, to get veteran service connected, to see, you know, us go from 18% of veteran service connected, which is really not really low ranking compared to other states, to 27-28%. Those are what, you know, high performing states are doing. I'd love to see Michigan veterans get taken care of. Predominantly veterans here in Michigan are Vietnam era. We failed those guys when they came home. I'd love to see this be the governor that does the right thing and takes care of them.
Stephanie Zarb, U.S. Air Force veteran, thank you for your service and thank you for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
Time for our reminder that we love it when you give us story ideas. So who or what do you know about you'd like to share with the rest of Michigan? Or what story has caught your interest? Who are the people doing something special to make our state better in some way? Let us know. It's very easy to reach us. You can email us, stateside@michiganradio.org, or we're on Facebook, search for Michigan Radio, and of course, Twitter @StatesideRadio. And always, you can go to the Stateside page at michiganradio.org and click the link that says Stateside. Tomorrow on Stateside, parts of Michigan got smacked with a big polar vortex over the winter, and now some fruit farmers are seeing their peach crop wiped out.
We have one orchard on one site, total loss. We will not be picking, seeing any peaches there. We did not have any blossoms on those peach trees. We do have an orchard, however. It is blessed with high ground and good drainage. We do have some peaches. It just comes down to questioning which ones will actually be viable at, you know, the end of the season.
Who got hit and how it's testing the eternal optimism of the Michigan farmer, that is next Stateside. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Joel Danilevitz, Anna Schlute, and Rebecca Tauber. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.